Welcome. It's wonderful for you to be here for our inaugural event. This is the Opiris Writer Conversations, brand new event that we are beginning. It's going to be monthly, and we will be highlighting different authors of different genres of writing where they will be sharing with you their expertise, their insights, and tips for writing, and speaking about their latest projects. My name is Sarah Crisp. I am the chief content creator of Opiris. And for those of you who are not familiar with Opiris, I know we have a number of Opiris members on, and we also have people new to Opiris. We are a self-betterment platform that really encourages anyone and everyone to tap their power to write, to enhance their emotional, physical, and financial well-being. And we have, this is one of the many offerings that you'll find at Opiris.com that really is going to help enable you to transform your life through writing. We are big believers that everybody is a writer in potential. Some just don't know it yet. So we're really excited to present to you our first Writer Conversations, where you will be able to gain insight from a very, very talented writer, Inette Miller, who I'm going to introduce in a moment. I want to just very quickly introduce you to the CEO of Opiris, who has been my tech support on this call as well, Mr. Art Gutch, who will introduce himself and say hello to you.
Great. I'm just going to say a few words. Thanks, Sarah. And of course, Sarah and I work together, but I've known Inette for a number of years, and she's got a super exciting background. It's just, we did a podcast some years ago, and I'm really anxious to see this because she is just full of, for those of you that know her, she's got great stories and has got a great full life that she's going to be talking about today, as well as being a super writer. So we're really happy to have Sarah taking on this conversation with Inette, and we'll be doing it monthly. And Opiris is in a new phase of its growth, and these are some of the, this is I think indicative of some of the new content that we're going to be bringing to our members. So I hope you enjoy it, and if there's anything I can ever do, you can always contact me through the Opiris website, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have. We're also doing, if you look in the chat, I just put in two URLs there. One is for to join Opiris if you haven't joined for free already. And then the other is for a WeFunder campaign that we're doing now to raise money, because we are building a new application in Opiris, and that's something exciting for the company right now. But that's all I'm going to say. Sarah and Inette, have a great time. I'm going to be sitting here listening. I'm going to take my video off, and please enjoy, everyone. And we'll be on the sidelines watching. Thanks.
Excellent. Okay, thank you, Art. So the way this evening is gonna work is we're gonna begin with some general questions I'm gonna be asking Inette about her writing process, writing in general, her tips and her guidance for that. And then we're gonna be discussing her phenomenal new book, which is Girls Don't. And if you have not yet read it, I highly encourage you to do so. You received a very generous 20% discount in the initial email you received about this, and we'll be discussing that book. Following that, we're gonna be taking questions from all of you. So you can send in your question at any point in the chat. I will be reading it, addressing it at the end, and we'll be opening it up at that point to the discussion. So our guest of honor this evening is Inette Miller. I'm gonna just do a formal introduction of her before we begin the questions. But Inette has been a national and international journalist, lecturer, and a writing workshop teacher throughout her life. She has published 3 memoirs and 1 collection of personal essays. Each memoir defines a pivotal, transformative life juncture within late 20th century cultural currents. Her memoirs have been produced as feature film, translated into 6 languages, and honored with national awards. She is a member of the Authors Guild, and Inette lives with her husband and Native Hawaiian cultural practitioner on the island of Kauai. So we're very excited, Inette, to have you here. And to begin with, I want to ask you, when did you first discover your love for writing? And what was the first thing you wrote where you actually considered yourself a writer?
Well, first off, thank you, Sarah, and thank you, Art, for the lovely introduction. I want to say about Art that he is a CEO who is very hands-on. And so in all of my experiences over the years with Art, when things went wrong, he was just a bit of a phone call away, and he got books where they needed to be or made problems disappear. So I'm truly honored and supportive of this new Opiris endeavor. So the question was, when did I discover myself as a writer? When did I? I've been writing since I was a child. I have either the honor or the horrible experience of having parents who would proudly parade me out at their social gatherings to read my work. I don't know that anyone should do that for any child ever, but in any case, that was the beginning. The other thing that I remember crystal clear is the first creative writing class I ever took was as a senior in high school. And I had just an extraordinarily young, beautiful, and brilliant teacher who all the boys ogled and were in love with and were angling to sit in the right place so that when she was up on the desk, they could see her legs well. But in any case, we were submitting things. And at the end of one of them, she wrote across my paper, "This is so Inette-y." And what she did was announced to me that I had a voice. I mean, I was 17 years old, that I had something unique that was Inette-y. And she said it, you know, over again out loud with a great deal of certainty that this defined something. Do you know, many, many, many years later, and quite recently, she and I had lunch together, and I told her the significance of this. And she remembered me. She didn't remember that at all. But I told her how instrumental it was. So in later years, when I taught writing, and I know this is not exactly part of the question, but my mind's going there, it was really important for me to tell prospective writers that essentially no one has your voice. You're born with it. Discovering it is part of what we did in my workshop and part of what you'll probably do at Opiris. But identifying myself as a writer was not the same as thinking I was going to make a career out of it, Sarah. Mm-hmm. I actually majored in psychology, worked at the school paper, took English courses, but did not take any writing courses in college because I thought I'm a writer. I thought I'm a writer. I will always write. I should go to college and fill myself with something other than that. And remember, I was living at a time too when I had very strict parental guidance that let me know that a woman who was single could absolutely not be a writer who could support herself. And that writing wasn't something in general that you did to make a living. And of course, I also lived in the era when the fallback was you'd be a nurse or you'd be a teacher. So I have a lot of years and they're pretty much reflected in Girls Don't, the stories, because there are flashbacks in that book to childhood. But all by way of saying that I didn't expect to make a career of writing. I got out of college, I had graduate school applications in for psychology, and I went back to Baltimore where I was from, and I was at the University of California at Berkeley at that time, and I went to a job fair at the Civic Center, and I walked around, looked, what could I do? What am I trained to do? Virtually nothing. And there was the Baltimore Sun, and I walked up, there was nobody sitting there, and I filled out a thing. I got called in. I had an incredible interview with an incredible editor, and life went on from there. Never looked back, never did anything else but writing my whole life.
Amazing.
Life is interesting. don't know how to go.
I think that's an incredible insight, that idea that once somebody hears your voice and helps you identify that you have a voice, that's usually the encouragement and support somebody needs to feel almost validated in the writing process. And that is actually our goal, to let everybody know you have a voice, you have a unique voice, and nobody else can tell the story that you have to share. And it's amazing that that was something revealed to you very, very early on. And that actually leads me to another question, which, following your background in writing, from my understanding, it seems that you began as a journalist, as a reporter, yeah, and that, you know, the reportage genre of writing is when you are not speaking about yourself. You're very specifically speaking about everybody else and asking them the probing questions and delving deep into their lives. And then you switched into the memoir writing, which is the internal probing questions and digging deep into your own story and into your own truth. So I'm curious about that shift from reportage journalism into memoir, and also which one now would you say you like more, or you find to be, or if they're just equal genres to you in terms of your love.
Which child is your favorite child? They're different.
Yeah.
Very, very different and satisfying in very different ways. I have commonly in the past given a speech talking about the evolution from journalism to memoir writing. What that asked of me, what that felt like, what that meant. Yesterday I gave a speech at an international Vietnam War conference in Texas, on Zoom, of course. This is what I said, and it wasn't, it's, it, I'm going to read just a couple paragraphs of what I said. When my son Sam was, and then I'll continue, I promise, Sarah. When my son Sam was 16 years old and an aspiring historian like his father, he was appalled when I said, I write creative nonfiction. He saw creative nonfiction as tinkering with the facts that violated his truth. I laughed then and I laugh now, because at 16, he would not nor could not hear what I answered him. My truth, my writerly truth, my memoir, my memory was never tied to Sam's idea of fact. The writing of memoir is the peeling off of protection, facing the truth of our own lives and experiences naked and emptied too of the desire for approval or for consensus. There is no consensus in the writing of memoir. There is only the barest bone held up to the sunlight and the discovery that follows. When I read that yesterday, I realized I was reading to hundreds and hundreds across the planet of academic historians. And I thought, woo! This is, and literally everyone at the conference was an academic historian of some prestige, and I was a memoir writer. And so that it was, and it was, I was invited because of Girls Don't, the new book, but it is a memoir, and that is a different thing. I started in journalism. I probably always was a feature writer by naturally. I wrote almost from the beginning. I showed a degree of talent in writing profiles of other people that allowed me that. But I was heavily trained, because I was ignorant of it, in writing news stories, solid news stories, and investigative reporting being the tip top of that. But gender-wise, and it's impossible to have this conversation without gender being an issue here, because it is very much an issue in this book. Gender-wise, what was valued in journalism was politics, crime to some degree if it were sexy enough. Those were male areas. Feature writing was something quite else. Actually, when I came back from reporting in Vietnam, and I'm going to jump here, I was working in Cleveland. And I worked in a very big newsroom of about 150 reporters. I was one of two women sitting in that newsroom there, off to the side, behind a white picket fence, mind you, was the women's department. And never the twain shall meet. There were a half dozen, maybe eight or nine, what's now been reclassified as feature in every major newspaper in America. I don't think there's still a women's section anywhere. And it's the best read section of every paper. Was then very strongly the women's section. I was hired as a medical writer, and I wrote prolifically, and I wrote well, and I had a bunch of front page stories. And then one day, I came in, and one of my stories was in the women's section. And I went to the city editor, and I said, under no circumstances, the person I replaced was a man. Not one of his stories ever appeared in the women's section. If you do this, I will quit. And I was pretty good at making those kinds of threats in those days. Jobs were easy to come by. Not so much for people now, I do understand that. So I'm not being too arrogant, but it was. He said, he made a lot of excuses. He said, I wanted to run it long and we had space there. And if I ran it in the normal part, the news section, I would have had to cut it. I said, we'll make the cuts. And he never did. So, boy, you asked me which I like best. I spent until I was 40 doing journalism with a significant break for having children. And at 40, my life changed in a lot of ways. And I felt as though I had written every story that I cared to, that, you know, once again, you know, it was the 4th of July parade came around again, or, you know, or the holidays, or I'd done every good one and every, you know, slower one. And I, you know, my first boss used to say there's no such thing as a bad story, just a bad reporter. And I'd gotten pretty adept at my craft, and I felt limited by it around that point in life. I felt that they had to be shorter than I wanted. I wanted to write longer. I wanted to write deeper. And so I published my first book. And from there was not really any looking back. I wrote for women's magazines to support children as a single mom for years, for some years, because they paid very well. And I did some things like that, but everything after that was memoir writing or first person writing. And for me, it's a whole other thing. As Sarah said, there's the out there, there's the that, there's the them, there's the distance, even if you're writing a feature profile. But in memoir writing, it's feeling empowered to expose the deepest, most profound feelings and ideas that you have, and you're putting them out there for public scrutiny. You know, I said when my first book came out, I said, you know, it's one thing to have people judging your book, your writing, and saying, you know, I hate it, or I love it, or you write terribly, or you write wonderfully. That's one thing, or all the rejections that come with that. But the other thing when you write memoir is that people judge you personally. So it's, you know, on my first book tour, you know, I can remember sitting on what was then the Phil Donahue show, and some woman, you know, just attacking me personally, you know, just, and I still remember it. And this is a lot of years ago. So yeah, you know, you can't change your writing to meet someone else's needs when you're writing memoir. It has to be. Yeah, that's the other thing I've said, because I remember having an agent that said to me, my God, you are exposing yourself. You are making yourself look bad in so many ways in this book. Protect yourself. And my feeling was, then write something else, then write fiction. If you're going to write memoir, there's no compromise. You either write it as authentically as you humanly can to the truth of those feelings, and again, it is yours, or if you're protecting yourself, don't bother. do something, write something else?
You touched on a few different questions I had throughout. I'm trying to debate where to go next, but being that you brought up the concept with feminism and how that really shifted, I'm going to jump into a question about that, because you were one of the few female journalists who was on the front lines in the Vietnam War, and your writing was very intertwined with your feminism, which is a key part of Girls Don't. So I'm curious your experience over the years and what began in such a male-dominated field. How do you think things have changed for you personally, and also just for women writers in general now, both in the reportage field and just writing? Like, has that been a complete shift from what you began with? You know, because as a writer myself, that it's a whole different ball game than what you experience.
Sarah, cynically, I want to say not enough. It hasn't changed enough. I keep getting kind of shocked at where the barriers are and the stereotypes and the diminishing of the female voice as a writer. But I do remember in the 60s that the publishing world was very different, and women's stories were not considered serious literature. So that has changed, and it's changed a great deal. Talk a little bit about what it was to be in Vietnam. It took me 50 years. It didn't take me 50 years of daily writing, but it took me 50 years to agree to write and publish Girls Don't. And it's because for the first 25 years, I'll say, I thought the story had already been told, and very well, by my colleagues. It didn't even occur to me in those first 25 years that I had a perspective that was unique and different and valuable. Didn't even occur for 25 years. So I at a time where, you know, where literally agents were asking me and editors were asking me, when are you going to write your Vietnam book? I said, it's already been written. Well done. Colleagues have done it. I awakened in my, I think it was late 40s, to an NPR story about Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara had published his memoir. And the person who was speaking about this memoir said, whoever you are, wherever you were, whatever you lived, if you lived through the Vietnam War, you carry with you a sense of failure. I was off in writing. I spent 2 years banging my head in my agent's frustration, producing nothing of value. I could not find my story. I still did not believe I had a story. So now we're, you know, now years and years go by. We're in the 20 somethings, you know, we're within the last 10 years. I was in a writing workshop. Not the ones that I taught, but one that where I was the student. And I wrote a 6-page narrative-free kind of writing thing. And at the end, my teacher repeated just one sentence back to me after I read it. And the sentence was, Saigon was a girl, not a city. And I was off in writing. That was it. It was the girl. It wasn't me now. It was that girl, and I was to find her again, that 23 to 25-year-old girl who had the chutzpah to send herself to war, who was ignorant in so many ways, blind in so many ways, but willing and eager to dive into that world and distinguish herself in it. I had to find her, and then the writing took off. Okay, there's an interesting thing, though, that happens here. Finding your story, which I definitely found, is different than finding your audience. Who cared about this almost 50-year-old war? Who cared? Who knew? Who even remembered it? And then the Me Too movement happened, and I found my audience. It was, oh. And then this book has gone through more drafts than, you know, it grew with my understanding. and the Me Too movement, the reinvigoration of the feminist movement that was so alive in the late 60s when I was experiencing it, was again bringing focus on the relations of men and women who we are together. And I thought, I've got an audience, male and female. And that's my hope.
Absolutely. I'd love you to actually give a quick synopsis for those who have not yet read the book or are familiar with it. What is astounding to me, even hearing you say that, having read it, it's so captivating, it's so powerful,
Thank you. It's so unique
that it's shocking that nobody else could, I mean, we just said this, nobody else could have written your story, but specifically your story, because it's an introduction, first of all, to a time period that, you know, later generations only know through the history books or other memoirs, but to see it through the lens of a young woman, a reporter, somebody who was not there as a soldier and yet intertwined, you know, with military life and what was going on. It's so exceptionally insightful, but I would love for you to give a very quick synopsis, and then I've got some questions. One is very much related to what you were just saying, but if you want to summarize for those who have not yet read it, and absolutely all of you should if you haven't.
Oh, thank you, Sarah. This was not a setup. This is genuine.
Oh, yeah. I literally couldn't put it down. I'm telling you, I started. This is the book, beautiful cover. It's Girls Don't, A Woman's War in Vietnam. It is really, truly an exceptional read.
You know, I'm not good at this. This is something after when my first book came out, I had a friend who was an author sit with me and say, you're going to get it down to 5 sentences. You are going to tell your story. She practiced me and practiced me. I've never done it with this book, so I'm going to try to do this.
Okay.
It's going to be more than 5 sentences, because I don't tend to do short. But
do you want me to do the 5 sentences and then I'll go into the question?
Yeah, I'm going to do my best. I was at my very first job at the Annapolis Evening Capital in Annapolis, Maryland. I had a boyfriend for 3.5 years, Bob, who plays a central part of this. The very short version is Bob gets drafted. There's every reason in the world he shouldn't go. He is a deeply, deeply religious Catholic boy who had actually gone to a monastery out of high school to study to be a brother and then left for his own reasons. So his deciding whether or not to go into this war when he gets drafted is huge. And that's a part of what goes on between us. So he has 10 days to report to Vietnam, and he's does not want to. We know nobody who's gone. Our people are educated, and they have a million reasons to be excused from this war. This war is being fought by people other than educated people, largely. So I know it's already more than 5 sentences. The very short story is, after dismissing all other possibilities, going to Sweden, going to Canada, too late to be a, he's already done his basic training and his advanced infantry training. He's been trained as an MP. He's going to be sent to Vietnam in 10 days. We decide to get married and go do the war together. I said, I'm a reporter. It's the best story around. Let's do it. Did not know that was one of our options. Did not know that was in my mind. We got married in 4 days, this Jewish girl from Baltimore, this Catholic boy from California. Our parents were there. That's all of this is in the book, in the slow version. And we wind up spending the next 14 months, him as a GI in that war, and me landing a job when I get there as a correspondent for Time magazine. And so the book kind of alternates almost chapter, but not that strictly, but a chapter of me doing my professional thing. It starts with a helicopter that I'm in. I almost die. Okay, the helicopter's shot down. It starts there. And I, when I speak about it, I typically say I started there for you men in the audiences. So you know I was there and I did that. But now we're going to tilt this a little bit. And now the story is different. Now it's a woman's story. Now it's a feminist story. And now I read a part that is very intimate and very personal and very bother me. So it is alternates between the married Inette in Vietnam and the professional Inette in Vietnam. And I think that the pull that I felt at back in 1970 and 71 when I was there, which was that pull of marriage versus career, how much do you give, how much do you support the husband, how much do you not, what does it ask, what does it take? I don't think that's a question that's resolved. I hope someday it will be, but I don't think it is yet. And so I do think that this struggle that this young Inette, this 23 to 25 year old goes through is something that is utterly and totally relatable now. At least that is my hope with this book.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, and I'm curious, writing this so many years later, you recount in such exquisite detail, emotions, demographics, scenery, geographics, so much. Is it difficult for you? Was it difficult, this journey, you know, the journey of writing this book, to relive traumatic events? Do you feel, you know, as a writer, that when you are retelling these stories, that it really, you relive these experiences in heart and mind to deliver them with such authenticity? Like, do you have to go back? Was that something that perhaps made you wait to write about this? Is that something that is a difficult process to go through?
That's a wonderful question. Maybe. Maybe. I have said that with an earlier book of mine. I have said that it took me 10 years to get up the courage to expose myself, that aspect of myself. And it was something very different than this. To friends who would cock an eyebrow at that story. So that is possible, though I didn't factor that into my conversation about this, even with myself. Do I have to go? You know, an awful lot of friends have asked me about the memory aspect. And by that, I don't mean the emotional part, but just how did you remember? I mean, I don't have a great memory. That is not my strong suit. I did have the gift of every letter I wrote to my mother and every letter I wrote to my mother-in-law. And that was an amazing gift. Not that you tell your mother and your mother-in-law Jack Diddley, you know, but you do describe basically what's going on and where you were. And you don't tell them what's going to frighten them, but you tell them a funny story about what it's like to be a woman, you know, in a male barracks, you know, I mean, whatever, you know. So let's see. I kind of lost my thread here. You have to go deep. You have to allow yourself to feel, or you cannot write what you have to write. But you can't allow the feelings to set up a whole chain of things like, what's my mother going to think? What's my husband going to think? If I say this, it means. Mm-hmm. If you do that, you can't write, period. Nothing will be authentic. You will not find voice and you will not allow yourself to find story. So there is the necessity, but rather than, and I haven't, this is such a good question because I really don't know the clear answer, but rather than feeling teary about it or feeling giddy about it, what I feel is, as a writer, I nailed it. I got that. There it is, you know? You know, and yes, there'll be lots of playing around the edges, and yes, there'll be editors, and yes, there'll be, you don't really need that paragraph, you know? But boy, I think the feeling is, that was it. I nailed it.
So along with that, that was one of the most powerful parts of the book for myself as a reader, was you recounted an incident where one of the Vietnamese workers for Time Magazine, who was faxing over your pieces, bringing them, getting them to the New York office, came up to you, walked in, and was crying and bowed. And it was after you had given him a piece recounting how the Vietnam War was affecting Vietnamese children, you know, the war on these children, what they were going through, which was clearly a very emotional piece. And you had said earlier that not everybody, or usually people didn't even get to read your actual pieces because they were so heavily edited and changed up by the New York office before they ever went to print. But seeing this man's reaction, and especially, sorry, when you weren't in the States to see the reaction of the readers, what kind of feedback did you get? What did that mean to you to know, like, nailed it, you know, here you...
Okay, two different questions. I'm wanting to stop you because I'm feeling like I want to answer both of them.
Sure.
So I'll start with the last and we'll go back to the first.
Sure.
So, because the first was deeply emotional. The editing. It's different in journalism than it is in book writing. Every book that I have written, every editor I've had has been deeply respectful of me and my work, or else they wouldn't have bought the book. So they enter with a certain humility and respect, and you enter with a deep, hopeful respect for their ability as a reader. So that never has anyone insisted that I make any change in any book ever. And yet I've made changes. And so in book writing, it has been us, in the old days it was stickums, you know, now it's on a computer screen, but it's okay, this, you know, this is pretty didactic. How about this sentence? This is, I see you're using slang here. Should we leave that in? But I was to say for each one of them, yes, no, yes, no, and that was the final word. In each, this is a university press, I've done commercial presses, I've done independent presses, it's exactly the same. Also happens is that your respected editor may say, I would like to see a prologue. I'd like to see a 3-page prologue. I think if you move the first paragraph of this over to that, I think it'll make it clearer. I think you need another paragraph here inserted in the story. I welcome that. I love that. If I respect the person I'm working with, then man, that's a great reader. And I've always been very, very protective of my writing. For years, I didn't let anyone, even my agent, see it until it was completed because I didn't want anyone entering my process. And that was a mistake. But the other, there's a way to be mistaken in another way, you writers out there, and that is to let all your friends and whatever read it because the responses aren't equally adept and equally enlightened. And they can kill your story in ways that it is your process, it is your story. And when you find the person who's offering some suggestions, it's like this. When someone offers me suggestions, it is like this. Not valid. It's not it. Oh my God, that's exactly what it means. That's it. As the writer, and there is a thing, and again, I'm going to say this because I used to edit manuscripts too. There's something, a professional accepts editing. A professional doesn't take it personally. A professional doesn't get their backup. I have been rejected more times than I can imagine. And I've said to my husband, he was laughing the other day. He said, there's something happened that I didn't want to happen. He said, you got 24 hours, right? Give myself 24 hours to complain, to bitch, to kvetch, to cry, and get on with it the next day. So that's that. But you were asking me about what was happening in Vietnam in this book. And as a journalist, there's always an editor and there's always editing. And that is the case. But with my experience in newspaper writing, my editors worked very hard to get as much of your story in, and the changes were very minor. Working for Time magazine was an entirely different story at that time. At that time, there were no bylines in Time magazine. The aim was to make the entire magazine look as though it were written by one person. So we've got a bunch of correspondents and photographers in Saigon or in Cambodia, and they're traveling throughout the countries, and they're getting their very hard news stories and seeing how many are killed and who isn't and what happened in that particular battle or whatever it was. And they write their story and they send it to New York. And New York Time Office, the corporate office, sends it to Washington, to the Pentagon correspondents, who go to the generals and ask their point of view. And that comes back. And there comes a story that is unrecognizable. So when I first started working for Time, a colleague of mine, Bob Anson, said to me, here's the deal, you're a good writer. That's great, this is a writer's magazine, but you won't recognize anything of yours that appears in the magazine, except for some of your quotes, they can't mess those up. But he said, but keep your files, and they weren't, this was pre-fax, my dear, so there wasn't fax, it was telex that was sending these things. Keep your telexes, which I do have fading telexes in a file cabinet somewhere, because you'll show them for your next job. So for me, it was, I couldn't even imagine this, but I was working with the influence of Time Magazine at that time was unmatched, and it meant doors opened to stories you wanted to write, and it meant that the exposure and the career opportunity was huge, but if you wanted to be attached to your work, it wasn't going to work. There, from there to there. And yeah, you know, we screamed and yelled. That's not what happened. I was there. The generals are lying. But whatever. There it was. But you'll find that struggle in the book as well.
So jumping up to the second part of that. So when this Vietnamese man working there was so moved by your actual writing, what you did write, whether or not that is what ended up making it into Time Magazine. Was that confirmation, you know, I would imagine it was very hard as a writer knowing that so much of your story wasn't going to actually be seen much it impacted?
None of that was a factor at all. I did not face, you know, I wrote each one as though it were the story. This was my story. You know, this was what I was going to live and die by. And the rest was something else. What you're speaking of, I had already been there at least a year. And I had gone from being the young reporter, 1 year's experience, one of the very rare women. The men that were there had been sent by their newspapers or news organizations, were established, were older, probably 30 to 35. I was 22, a year out of college. So a year into it, I'd gone from wanting to imitate them, wanting to be them. They were my heroes, wanting to be accepted by them, to realizing that that was thinking too small, that there was more, and that I contained that more because I was a woman, and that there were experiences that I had because I was a woman, and there were things that I could write because the men didn't write those things. And so I had a bureau chief who decided to give me a plum assignment that was to be the cover story, which is big. And I threw my heart into it. And the cover story was to be Children of War. They gave me a long, almost a month to write it. I wrote 30 some pages. Of course, 30 some pages aren't going to appear, but you always overwrite because you want. And I interviewed 14-year-old prostitutes who my colleagues hired and would never think of interviewing. I went and lived the lives of the street boys, these kids called delinquents. Basically orphaned for all practical purposes, kids who lived on the street, these boys, who my colleagues would walk past and put a dollar in their hat, but would never think to engage. It opened when I opened myself up to greater sensibilities of what was happening to this culture and the people in it. Then I opened my heart and my writing in ways that I couldn't have seen a year before. And so the Children of War story, my bureau chief left me to page by page. It's late at night. I'm writing this thing in this dark office. And we have about 9 Vietnamese staffers among our, it was just 3 of us and a photographer. And the staffer that sends the telex, he would come in and he would take it page by page and send it. And, you know, the truth is that this is a man who spoke to almost no one. He did his job. He was quiet. He was an incredible typist or whatever that telex machine requires. And he got the language and everything perfectly. And but he wasn't one of the more active Vietnamese in our office. This was what he did. And so I really have had in that year very little contact with him. Page by page, page by page, he'd come in and he'd collect the next page. I just turn it over there. And then all the pages were there. And I stood up and I was looking at my reflection in the mirror and I was thinking about these children. I was thinking about the orphanages teeming with children who, there was never orphanages in Vietnam. Family took care of children. I had written about the dislocation in the background to the story. And I was standing there when Nha walked in. And he walked over to me and I said, what's wrong? And he had tears running down his face. And he just put his hands together and he bowed to me and he turned and he walked. And I thought, okay. That's what this was about. That's why I'm here. I'm so honored. You know, all of us have a few things in our life that truly honor us. And that's it. Thank you, Sarah.
Beautiful. I have so many more questions. I want to respect everybody's time here. I want to make sure we have an opportunity to hear from people who have questions as well. That was such a beautiful, profound response to that, though. And I think that's it. You know, there's that point where we feel like, wow, I'm a writer, and somebody else validates it. And then when we know why we're a writer, and when you see that impact, and you realize that your words touched somebody in that way and changed them and impacted them so deeply. And it was such a beautiful part of the book amidst so much else and in such a moment of just pure shared humanity. It was very, very powerful. So I think that was a beautiful place actually to switch it over. I want to thank you so much for your time. I want to open this up to questions. I just want to also let everybody know we are going to be posting on the site the recording of this. I know somebody asked a question that I saw at the beginning that you did address earlier on with the, you know, the part of your earlier life. So you will be able to watch this recording. And we are also going to be posting within the next week or so when we get that video up. Inette also did for us 3 wonderful podcasts. And there is an earlier interview that Art had done with Lynette a number of years ago, but we're going to have also on the podcast of the evolution of a flourishing memoir writer and writing to find your voice. So I'm going to read the one question that came in that hasn't been addressed in full yet. And also please, if the rest of you have questions, put them in the chat now. If not, we can definitely, if we have a few more minutes. I have plenty more to ask, but there is a question from Jonah, and he wants to know, he writes, as an author, I try my utmost to stay true to myself and my word choice and language style and not feeling pressured by outside voices of how my writing, what not entirely sure what he meant there, but what should be shouldn't be included. But sometimes editors and publishers have a specific decorum you're expected to follow and can really suck your soul from what you created. How do you reconcile being true to yourself and meeting the requirements of the publisher and editor? And that he can think of a number of times that that happened over the years. And I would imagine, just to jump in with this, that that's also probably something that evolved. I think that as a writer, it becomes more established. You also have, you know, more voice that people respect. I think that, you know, just reflecting back, I would imagine how that impacted you earlier on in your writing career versus now is also probably a different response.
You know, the soul sucking for me came only writing for women's magazines. And I finally had to quit that, even though that was, I was a single mom at that point. And it paid very well at that time, because it was soul sucking. And it was soul sucking because you were writing to formula and to form. And it was soul sucking because it felt terribly artificial and not real. And I thought at that point, I used to make lists, you know, I thought at that point, if I waitress, it will suck less out of me because it won't be competing for my writing time. My writing time should be pure. And now my writing time is being confused with something that feels very unhealthy. That's as close as I can come, because unlike you, with my very first book, I had the experience of the vice president of the publishing house and the publisher of the house saying to me, this is your book. And it was a memoir. And it is, if you want to use that word, if you want to use slang, we are not, you know, I'm going to make suggestions and it's up to you. It was, so I'm not sure, I'm sorry, Jonah, but I guess I'm going to say it's a very fine line that, so you are an author, so you are a published author, and I don't know where these experiences are arising, and, you know, something that we can, you know, talk about, you can email me and we can talk about in another way. Because it sounds either disrespectful or, not knowing you, you're being very thin-skinned and thick and tough-backed about the process of revision. It isn't about, for me, I've never experienced someone insisting that I write to a formula, except if I knew that I was writing to a magazine, that there was a formula. But in terms of writing a book, it's not someone wanting to write to a formula, but revision is about your stepping back and with the help of maybe some other voices saying, whoa, I could do that differently. That might make a difference. And yes, I know when you're first starting out, you don't have that kind of confidence in your own voice. And so I don't know you, Jonah, and I'm sorry if this is not a very satisfying answer. But that's the fine line I'm asking you to examine yourself and make sure that you know, the act of revision isn't something. How many of us think, I have finished this draft, it is done, and I am ready now to send this off, only to have someone read it and say, Or if you waited 3 months and you read it, and if you allow that to happen in those 3 months, you say, oh boy, you know, maybe not. Every year of revision of Girls Don't made it better. Every revision, every draft made it better. And the first draft, the person who wrote the first draft could not have imagined the finished book. I consider smart people giving me ideas to be helpful. I know when they're helpful and when they're not, and that's a developed skill. But the process is the process. It's hard work, it's long, and it's lots and lots of drafts, and that's the gift and that's the work.
So Annette, that actually works perfectly with the next question, taking it to a totally different area, but you just hit on this. Elaine wants to know if Girls Don't is different now than it would have been if you had published it when you first
began. Elaine, nice to see you, hear you. Anyway, I don't see you. Elaine, Okay, so my writer friend Elaine, very different, so different. You know, over the years, okay, you know, and it goes back to memory too. The first draft was written 25 years ago, okay? So there was also, I was closer to the 20, you know, so the first draft was 25 years ago and it was frustrating. I couldn't, but it was there. So, you know, it was there. Over the years, I would, you know, put the last chapter to the front. I would change a few things to make it prettier. I'd drop out paragraphs. I'd put a few more. Still nothing. Years went by. I'd pull it up again. I'd make a few changes. I'd do this and that. Not until the combination of Saigon was a girl, not a woman, not a city. Saigon was a girl, not a city. When I heard that, I knew the focus was her and I had to get out of the picture. It couldn't be me. It had to be that young girl. And then the Me Too movement. And I said, oh my God, I was a woman there. I was a married woman there. There wasn't another, generals did not have their wives in Vietnam. It was verboten. And a PFC certainly couldn't have his wife in Vietnam. And yet there we were. I had a story, but boy, yes, Elaine, you know from experience. We welcome every draft. We hate it at the time that someone says to us, that an editor says, this is really gonna be good. And you know, it's not there yet, but I thought this was it. Welcome it. That's being a pro.
Okay, I'm gonna combine now two questions because somebody else asked, also about something earlier, so I'm going to read them to you both. It says from Jerry, Inette, I know of you and your work only from Grandmother's Whisper and the short stories after that, and then you're journeying across the USA. You and Iokepa.
Iokepa.
Thank you. Okay, I knew I think I was avoiding it because I didn't know how to pronounce that one.
Oh,
Iokepa. Wonderful, wonderful books. Didn't know of your earlier life. I arrived at your talk slightly late, perhaps I missed something. And then the second one that also had to do with that from Christina is, did you do a brief bit about your life with Iokepa?
Iokepa.
Thank you.
No, I didn't talk. I have not talked one bit tonight about any of that. And you are not the only folks to have come to my writing from my last two books. And all that, my husband is a Native Hawaiian cultural practitioner. And I have written two books about my immersion in these last 23 years into his culture, which I did not even know there was a Native Hawaiian culture. So I started from scratch. And he works as what's called a kahu, a guardian of the Aboriginal culture. I take all that very seriously, but I'm a Jewish girl from Baltimore. And I say that when we speak about those two books that you're making reference to, Grandmother's Whisper and The Return Voyage, which are the books about that part of the life. So many people who came into my life from that combined work that my husband and I do now, had no idea. When I moved to Hawaii 23 years ago and entered this whole other world and this whole other way of living, it didn't seem relevant anymore to talk about what and who I'd been. Over the years, when we talk about, when we speak together around those two books and around his work, and we stand up and speak together, I'm very clear that I am a guest in my husband's culture, that we observe Sabbath, that we observe Pesach, Passover, that we observe the high Jewish holidays, that we belong to a congregation, a Jewish congregation. He is not Jewish. He is supportive of me and wants me to observe my Jewishness. I am not a Native Hawaiian. I am utterly and totally a guest in someone else's culture. My mama reared me to know how to be a good guest in somebody else's home. So maybe in our home, we put our feet on the coffee table, and maybe in somebody else's, you don't. So that has been the way that I have escaped being accused by Dear Hawaiians of being a cultural appropriator. But those of you who entered at that point in my life, and I was not young when I met E.O. Kepa 23 years ago, knew nothing about, and I wasn't particularly talking about it. I said I was a writer, you know, that was it. Here are my books. But Girls Don't goes to the earliest. And I think they're both wonderfully different aspects of a full life. You know, you don't get to this age, and you'll have to figure it out. I'm not going to make it easy for you. But you don't get to this age without having lived a whole sequence of events and lives. And I've been blessed. I've just been blessed. So I don't know. Was I to answer something there that I didn't get to? It's very possible. This is, you said it would be informal, and it is.
Absolutely. Okay, so we're just past 9 o'clock, and I know we said we would try to keep the call to that. So what I'm going to do at this point, I'm going to stay on. I will unmute people. You're all welcome to stay on if you want to get to speak to one another. If you have any questions for myself, Annette, you are more than welcome to stay. Again, they have so many other questions I would love to ask, but I don't want to keep people here. If you'll just maybe wrap up with if you're currently working on another writing project or what is next for you in the writing world, and then I will formally end the interview part of this.
Okay. Am I allowed to say I don't know? Sure. I think both Girls Don't and Grandmother's Whisper are eminently filmatic. And I've never written a screenplay. So if there is interest, that's something that would be a whole new ballgame for me. And I have friends who are very capable of doing a really wonderful job of it. So it's something that I play with in my head. I continue to write op-eds, essays, opinion pieces for various places. There's something called the Civil Beat out of Honolulu, which is the news source, the serious news source for all of Hawaii. And they've been very generous with allowing me to write my first person opinions of things and get that off my chest. And, you know, I continue to do the work around my husband's culture. So not a specific project, though I must say that my writer friends are as merciless as you are about asking what's next. Because all of us say, you know, that the day your book is published, you better have started your next project, because it takes so long for the publishing process. So even from the moment that my publisher signed a contract, it was going to be another year till it saw the light of day. So you're going to sit around that year, you know, and think about the book? I think not. So, you know, it is, I am giving advice that I sometimes am better at following than others. But it is, by the time your book comes out, it is history as a writing project. It is mine as history in all ways. But so I just want to thank you, Sarah. I want to take this to thank all of my friends who signed on. I hope this was what you expected, and I hope it's not. It fulfilled in some way. I don't see you. I don't see your faces, but I did. So many of you wrote me to tell me you'd be here tonight, and I really have you in my heart. Each of you, before I signed on, I was talking to E.O. Kepa, and I was saying, Elaine, yes, I did. But this person, Nancy, I saw you, but from Marianne, if I don't say a name, they're going to body, Lord.
My iPad is waving to you, just so you know.
Oh, to my friends. Friends that I don't see. I'm a supporter of Opyrus. I don't work for them. I have contributed several, she's calling them podcasts, speeches, whatever you want, that are on theirs. And I definitely recommend, if you're interested in continuing that conversation deeper. And this has just been fun. This has just been nothing but fun, Sarah. And Art, thank you. I'm sure you're still on. Thank you. And I guess you're going to all go and do your conversation thing now. So I suppose I'm supposed to click something or you'll click me.
Dinette, thank you. It's been absolutely wonderful. If you have any additional questions that you didn't get to ask or you want to, you can feel free to email me. I will pass them on to Dinette. Again, we are going to be posting the recording of this for anybody who may have missed the beginning. Oh. And we will also be having our next Opiris writer conversation on Sunday, May 23rd. So if you do the registration for free on Opiris, you will be getting an email about that. And we'll follow up with you as well.
Sarah, one last thing I didn't say. Because you said that they had to email you, you can email me directly, guys. So here's the deal. Inettemiller.com, www.inettemiller.com is my website. At the bottom is my email. I answer all personal emails. I answer no long-linked things. So that's my, this conversation can continue and my friends know that I do that. So good night and thank you all. Thank you. Thank you, friends and others.
Inette, if they go on inettemiller.com, there is a link as well for Girls Don't. And if you use the discount code GIRLS20, I didn't include it in the emails because they kept going to people's spam boxes because of the promotion. So it's not there. I can send it to you if you've lost it, but you can get right through Inette's website to purchase Girls Don't as well. So thank you all for making this such an exceptional first Opiris writer conversation. Yay, I see you all clapping. I'm going to unmute anybody who wants to stay on. Inette, you can click yourself off if you would like to. And thank you. Very grateful to all of you.
Thank you.
Okay, you're now all officially unmuted. So just remember that. If you talk, we will hear you.
I can't get out of here. Oh, leave.
Okay.
Okay, and Inette is gone. All right, so thank you, all of you.
I think so.
Boxes.
Hi, Christina.
Hi.
Hello.
I thought this was her when I saw that's this. It's like, it's Inette. Yes, that's her book. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Grandmother's Whisper.
Hi, and that's where Inette. The three of us. It's
yes. Inette jumped off.
It's Gus and Wilma from California.
And that's also, she can't hear.
Hello, Inette. It's Gus and Wilma from California. We're loving the book.
So Inette jumped off, but I will pass her the message.
I'm doing it. Okay.
And
thanks.
You are all through Inette's group, the people I'm seeing. Please. Join us at opiris.com. You'll see some of her other wonderful material on that. The classes she did for us are really very powerful, wonderful. And there's also an interview she did a number of years ago. So you'll hear, you'll have been able to see the evolution. It was pre-Girls Don't to post-Girls Don't. That was led by Art Gutch, the CEO of Opiris, who spoke before.
Sarah, can I ask you a question?
Please.
One of my friends was trying to get on the whole time, and she couldn't get on. Will she be able to? She was registered, and she just, for some reason, she kept getting this glip thing. But anyway, will she be able to hear the recording?
Absolutely. What I'm going to do is send everybody who is registered on this call, because we had a large group of people who were registered and didn't make it. Which generally happens anyway, but also that discount code created a problem where a lot of people didn't see the link. So everybody who's registered, if you know of other people, as soon as this is available online, I will be sending you all an email with the link so you'll have access to this call. And again, the discount code is Girls Don't. I didn't put it in the chat because this is going to be on the website and it's not available to everybody. The publisher made it just available to the people registered for this call, but there is a 20% discount on the hardcover book. So yes, all of you will be able to watch it again. We'll do an audio and a video option, and anybody who missed it And then we'll be doing these monthly with different authors. So the next one will be May 23rd, and we'll be announcing soon who that author is.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much.
She go to her like our website.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Sarah.
Yes, yes.
And Art.